In Sex and the UFO, she recounts, "I worked with George Adamski for 5 years, knew him for 9 years prior to his death in 1965. I promoted his public lectures for many years and saw him in all kinds of situations. In my booklet, Flying Saucers, I wrote about him suddenly grabbing me and kissing me smack on the lips in the hotel suite I had arranged for him to stay in. Another time he accidentally put his hand on my bosom as he helped me from the car. And later he rubbed my knee under the table with his knee, when the committee and I took him out to dinner after the lecture. But this playful behavior had never gone any further, and she decided it was part of a public persona Adamski had." Mundo believed that Adamski had not died, but had been taken aboard a spaceship, along with other notables to be brought back to Earth in the days of the space people's arrival. Adopted, to disconcert his critics. Yet other aspects of his personality did bother her. In the same pamphlet she writes, "I first met Adamski in March 1954 at the Detroit train depot when he arrived from California to lecture for the first Detroit Adamski committee, with me handling the unprecedented pioneering promotion of the lecture itself. Adamski drew in his breath sharply when he met me, and I knew he had met his opposite polarity. I had to fight personality-wise to survive all the time I escorted him about locally to radio, TV and newspaper interviews. Or introduced him from the platform. He was a male chauvinist and tried to push me into a corner wherever, whenever he could. Which I learned not to allow. He began to discuss me unflatteringly behind my back. Which always got back to me, of course, and insulted women in general and me in particular whenever he could." Mundo gives another example of that chauvinism. In the Mundo UFO report, she tells of Adamski's reaction to her claim of having met Orthon. Adamski became furious. Orthon was his private property, he apparently felt, and he was not going to share him, especially with a woman. Adamski had a tendency to be a male chauvinist, or the negative polarity of atomic energy being through him. "I was with Adamski in California when Elizabeth Clara Fielding reported her eyed in a flying saucer, like the ones he saw and rode in South Africa in 1956. Adamski became furious at that time, also. She had stolen his ideas from his books, he insisted. But if it was the same type of ship and the same type of space people, how could she have told it any differently? Despite all this, she continued to admire Adamski. His critics, she believed, were unfairly putting him down. Some people did not believe Adamski because he was rough-edged, or because his story of a ride in the space people's ship was too far-fetched for their infrared electronic, intellectual, skeptical, minds, considering him a poor choice by the space people, their egos showing. For she had decided that, whatever his shortcomings, he had to be telling the truth. How did she know? I had my own proof beyond my intuition, of his authenticity," she explains in Sex and the UFO. The same type of bell-like saucer he had photographed over his home in California came over my home in Dearborn, Michigan, later in 1954. And seeing was believing. What, then, are we to make of Laura Mundo, of this woman who describes herself as a pioneer interplanetary researcher? Some will see her as typical of the credulous individuals attracted to subjects like flying saucers. Credulous she may have been. But I prefer to see her as typical of something else, of the dedicated amateur. The ranks of ufology and other such movements are composed almost entirely of enthusiasts like her. They are people who work out of a passion, however misguided that passion may be. Mundo never charged for her newsletter, pamphlets, or lectures. She gave completely of her time and funds, in behalf of a cause, a consuming passion. That cause gave shape and meaning to her life, lent excitement and challenge to her days, brought her face to face with Orthon. The pyramid hat: while in space, you'll be exposed to cosmic radiation. That may sound scary, but in fact it's a golden opportunity. The cosmic rays, properly focused, can benefit you immensely. How are cosmic rays to be focused, to be gathered and utilized? Simple. With a pyramid hat. I'll tell you how to make such a hat. But first some background. The ancient Egyptians believed that asleep in every soul was a god. This god could be awoken by the power of a pyramid. So they buried their kings in pyramids. Moreover, the priests who conducted the burials wore pyramid-shaped hats. The hats attracted solar energy and put the priests in contact with Ra, the sun god. With the advent of Christianity, the pyramid hat fell into disuse. Yet a version of it would survive in the occult tradition, the conical cap of wizards. Such a cap was worn by John Duns Scotus, a medieval philosopher. But Duns Scotus had his detractors, and their mockery of his outdated cap and views led to dunce becoming a term of derision. Thus, the priestly headwear devolved into the schoolboy's cap of shame. Yet in recent years, the pyramid hat has been making a comeback, thanks to a Czech engineer named Karel Drbul. In 1959, Drbul received a patent for the Cheops pyramid razor blade sharpener. This was a tabletop pyramid, made of cardboard. When a used razor blade was placed inside it, the blade sharpened. How was that possible? No one really knew, not even Drbul. But Dr. George Wilkins, hypnotherapist, UFO contactee, in touch with Sanat Kumara, Lord of Venus, and pioneer pyramidologist, has offered an explanation. He says a pyramid acts as a resonator for cosmic energy, in the same way that a violin does for sounds. Thus, the energy is focused on the live crystals of the blade, and they are recharged. This positive effect, claims Wilkins, can be extended to people. He recommends placing a pyramid under your bed, to promote spiritual and physical regeneration. Drbul's sharpener was marketed in Europe and America. Word about pyramids spread, and New Agers were soon erecting open-frame versions, inside which they slept, meditated, and watched TV. Then Drbul came up with another idea. The pyramid hat. In their book Pyramid Power, Warner Books, 1976, authors Max Toth and Greg Nielsen tell us that Drbul, having launched the craze for household pyramids, became interested in the possible benefits of wearing a pyramid on one's head. Wasn't the cone-shaped hat of wizards, he asked himself, essentially a pyramid? Drbul began to experiment with pyramid hats. His work was carried on by an American researcher, who reported powerful flows of energy spiraling down from the hat. Explained the researcher, apparently, the pyramid acts like a kind of cosmic antenna tuning into sources of energy of vaster intensity and then focusing it into its center. In other words, the hat gathers cosmic rays and focuses them on your head. Now such a hat can be used here on Earth. But it is especially effective out in space, where cosmic rays abound. And that's why a ride in a UFO is your golden opportunity, your chance to reap the full benefits of cosmic rays. All you need is a pyramid hat, and they're easy to make. Scrounge about the saucer for some cardboard, scissors, and tape. Cut out four triangles. Each should measure 10 inches by 9 and 1/2 inches by 9 and 1/2 inches. Tape them together into a pyramid, with the 10-inch sides forming the open base. Now go sit in the lounge, pour yourself some nectar, and don the hat. As cosmic rays are focused on your head, you should experience a surge of mental energy. The potential benefits? Users of the hat have reported expanded consciousness, enhanced psychic abilities, and relief of cold symptoms. Some have even heard a mystical intonation, a deep and distant tome, the hum of the universe. So why not give the pyramid hat a try? It could provide a memorable moment in your UFO experience. And even the space people will be impressed. How do they fly? When asked about their propulsion system, the space people are deliberately vague. So we're still not sure by what means the saucers fly. Dr. Hermann Oberth believed they were powered by the conversion of gravity into energy. Other theories put forth have involved plasma dynamics, antimatter, reversible electromagnetism, the piezoelectric effect, orgone energy, etheric force, photons, and the progravitic principle, Adamski. Also suggested has been the use of a paradox engine. Such an engine would generate a time travel paradox, forcing nature to avoid paradox, as nature must, through the release of huge amounts of energy. But our best guess is that UFOs nullify gravity with microwaves. Even microwave ovens, to a small degree, nullify gravity. Look closely and you'll see that slice of pizza hovering slightly. A Martian temple near the harbor in Newport, Rhode Island, is an old stone tower. Known locally as the Mystery Tower, this antiquity is of unknown origin. English colonists, Algonquins, Norsemen, Welshmen, Knights Templar, Phoenicians, Atlanteans, all have been credited with its erection. But the archaeological evidence is ambiguous, and no one really knows. According to Buck Nelson, though, the riddle is solved. The tower was built by Martians. While on Mars, says Nelson, he was shown a temple, and it resembled the Newport Tower. Thousands of years ago, he goes on to explain, a group of Martians sojourned on the Atlantic coast. They built a temple in which to conduct their religious rituals, and the Mystery Tower is what remains of that temple. You might want to travel to Newport and visit the Mystery Tower. Its stones will give you a sense of the tangible reality of Martian civilization. Elvis, is there a link between Elvis and UFOs? Did he receive his early songs from space? Was he abducted by a UFO during his lifetime? And is he flying about today in one? Questions like these have been raised by the tabloid press and by serious ufologists. Laura Mundo, for instance, thought he may have been a cosmic changeling. In the Mundo UFO report, she speculates, Elvis Presley, a twin, might have been a transplanted space baby, not allowed to remember who he was as part of his and our spiritual education. And Richard Daniel, author of The Elvis UFO Connection, Castle Rock Enterprises, 1987, draws our attention to the sobering possibility that Elvis had been abducted and influenced by aliens. Much of his life, the author points out, was clouded in mystery. Since his supposed death, that mystery has continued. Reports have circulated of UFOs hovering over the tomb at Graceland. A guard told People magazine, I have seen the spacecraft around here several times. They always come between 2 and 4 o'clock in the morning when hardly anyone is around. And Laura Mundo believed Elvis was aboard a flying saucer. In the Mundo UFO report, she declares, it is my understanding that such popular leaders as Presley, John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Sir Winston Churchill, etc., have not died but have been taken for a rest into the space people's ships to return after the planetary peak to help bring in the universal way of life, along with others. Maybe so. And maybe Elvis will be aboard your saucer. If so, be sure to seek him out. Imagine peeking into the lounge and there he is, sitting on a sofa, strumming on his guitar. Elvis in a glittering jumpsuit. Ask him for his autograph and some words of wisdom. Talk about making the most of a flying saucer experience. A summing up, we have come a long way since the days when man deemed himself the sole inhabitant of the universe, the raison d'etre of creation, the creature for whose existence the entire cosmos served as a mere backdrop. Today we recognize that the heavens teem with intelligent life, that the Earth is but one of countless inhabited planets, surpassed by many in technological and cultural attainments. And we have come to realize that beings from some of those planets have been visiting us, with important lessons to convey. Let us learn from these beings. Learn, from the space people, to banish negative thoughts, to expand our consciousness and horizons, to live wisely. Learn, from the Martians and Venusians, to embrace utopian ideals. Learn, from the aliens with party horns for noses, to greet each day with joy and simple gusto. And learn, from the space aliens, to spot the flaws in our healthcare and other social programs. A flying saucer experience may well come our way. If it does, we must strive to have it, to use it to improve, empower, and enrich ourselves, spiritually, remember, as well as financially. And lastly this, of course, it is conceivable that my original view was correct, that we are alone in the universe. Who knows? Maybe those photos that so impressed me are fakes. Maybe Adamski was a charlatan. Maybe sightings are prompted by luminous owls, weather balloons, and such. Maybe encounters are psychic or psychological in nature. In these days of rapidly evolving knowledge and shifting paradigms, it is hard to be sure of anything. For more on this question, see Appendix. Should an extraterrestrial ever reach out to press our palm, let us reciprocate with enthusiasm. In affirmation of the brotherhood of all beings. The extraterrestrial life debate: are there really beings like ourselves throughout the universe? Only in recent centuries has the idea become respectable. Formerly, the universe was believed to be a lonely place, with intelligent life existing on one planet only, our own. It would scarcely have occurred to an ancient Greek, for example, that other worlds might exist, that the Earth might not be the center of the cosmos, or that anyone other than gods might inhabit the heavens. It is true that a dissenter from this view would occasionally arise. Such was Lucretius, who in his De Rerum Natura wrote, "So we must realize that there are other worlds in other parts of the universe, with races of different men and different animals." But until the dawn of the modern era, few agreed with him. The Earth remained central, mankind, unique, and the heavens, heavenly, inhabited solely by gods or angels. But as astronomers delved deeper into the secrets of the sky, more rumblings of dissent were heard. One of the rumblers was Nicholas Copernicus, who insisted that the Sun, not the Earth, was the center of the cosmos. It was a minor adjustment, though, in what remained a traditional scheme of things. The heavens revolved still about the neighborhood, if not the actual abode, of man. Thus, our exalted view of ourselves was not threatened by the new thinking, until Giordano Bruno leapt into the fray. The 16th century iconoclast insisted, among other heresies, that the solar system was not central, that other worlds existed throughout the universe, and that those worlds were inhabited by intelligent beings. Alas, there, universe soon had one less such being, as Bruno, arrested for heresy and unwilling to recant, was put to death for his views. Why were views like his considered dangerous? Because the heavens were deemed to exist solely for the delight and contemplation of man, who dwelt at their center. By suggesting that we were but one of countless inhabitants of the universe, and not central to it, Bruno was deflating our dignity and upsetting the order of the cosmos. But the idea was loose, and our self-image was about to change. The key figures in that change were astronomers, starting with Galileo. Prior to his aiming of an optical toy, the telescope, at the sky, little was known of the dimensions or constitution of heavenly bodies. But as they were observed in increasing detail, these distant worlds were perceived to be of the same nature as our own, and deemed inhabited. And it was not long before a once heretical notion had become widely accepted. By the 18th century, even such traditionalists as Cotton Mather had come over to the new model of the universe. Writes Mather, "Great God, what a variety of worlds hast thou created! How stupendous are the displays of thy greatness, and of thy glory, in the creatures, with which thou hast replenished those worlds! Who can tell what angelical inhabitants may thus see and sing the praises of the Lord? Who can tell what uses those marvelous globes may be designed for? Of these unknown worlds I know thus much, 'tis our great God that has made them all." Meanwhile, astronomers were seeking evidence of those inhabitants. Sir William Herschel, the leading astronomer of the day, kept an eye out for extraterrestrials, "I hope, and am convinced, that sometime or other very evident signs of life will be discovered on the moon." By Reef from the Christian Philosopher. Quoted in Michael J. Crow, The Extraterrestrial Life Debate 1750-1900, Cambridge University Press, 1986. My source for much of this information. Reflecting a little on the subject, I am also convinced that those numberless small circuses, craters, we see on the moon are the work of lunarians and may be called their towns. And certain individuals were soon claiming to have seen extraterrestrials. Emanuel Swedenborg, scientist and visionary, encountered, in his trances, dozens of them. And Ellen Harmon White, the founder of Seventh-day Adventism, had a vision of Saturn and its tall, majestic people. Yet the notion of multiple worlds, with intelligent inhabitants, was still considered heretical in some quarters. And midway through the 19th century, the debate grew heated. It centered around two men, William Ewell and Sir David Brewster. Ewell, master of Trinity College and one of the most learned men in England, held fast to a modified view of the traditional cosmos. The Earth, he conceded, might not lie at the center of the universe, but it was the sole home of intelligent life. Brewster, an eminent physicist, and the inventor of the kaleidoscope, believed just as strongly in multiple inhabited worlds. In 1853 Ewell published of the plurality of worlds, an essay, in which he maintains that we are the sole and highest product of the universe. It required an entire universe, he explains, to fashion so noble a creature as man, the elevation of millions of intellectual, moral, religious, spiritual creatures to a destiny so prepared, consummate, and developed, the ascent of their immortal souls to heaven, is no unworthy occupation of all the capacities of space, time, and matter. He presents both scientific and theological arguments against the existence of inhabited worlds other than our own. A proliferation of such worlds is unlikely, argues Ewell, given the exacting conditions needed to support life. Moreover, proliferation would be irreconcilable with the Christian scheme of salvation. A single seat of intelligent life is all that is required from the universe, to provide an arena of moral contests for the highest prizes, that is, for a mortal life with God. Ewell began his essay by quoting the psalmist, "When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars, which thou hast ordained, what is man, that thou art mindful of him? And the son of man, that thou visitest him?" And he goes on to answer eloquently the question. Man, declares Ewell, is the very purpose of God's creation. Our earthly abode is a worthy and sufficient product of all the universal scheme, while the stars, awesome as they may be, are mere sparks that had darted from his awful anvil when the solar system lay incandescent thereon. Of the plurality of worlds, with its impassioned denial of plurality, caused a stir among intellectuals, and elicited numerous replies. Of these, none was so widely read and influential as that of Sir David Brewster, who, after groaning at every line and pronouncing the book quite disgusting, penned a scornful review of it. The review was personally abusive of Ewell, describing his thesis as the product of an ill-educated and ill-regulated mind. A mind dead to feeling and shorn of reason. Utterly inept and illogical, the following year Brewster published a book of his own, More Worlds Than One, The Creed of the Philosopher and the Hope of the Christian, in which he presents the case for a plurality of worlds. The universe, insists Sir David, is filled with inhabited worlds. Every star has a planetary system, which is the home of intelligent life. For it was to be populated that stars and planets had been fashioned in the first place. Why else would God have bothered to create them? Even the solar system, he assures us, is a plurality of worlds. There are Jupiterians, Lunarians, Solarians. This proliferation of life is to the greater glory of God, and only a small mind, like Ewell's, could believe otherwise. As for the objection that pluralism is incompatible with Christianity, is each world to have its own savior? Its own salvific religion? Brewster replies that Christ's redemptive act extends throughout the universe. The Catholic Church has come to agree with Brewster, at least, according to the Weekly World News. A recent issue describes how the Vatican has trained a team of outer space. In the debate that ensued, most scientists sided with Brewster, while clerics were divided between the two points of view. Finally, it was Brewster's scheme of things, or a modified version of it, minus the Jupiterians, Lunarians, and Solarians, and the insistence that every star was inhabited, that won the day, and would become the prevailing cosmology of the modern world. Though no proof had been obtained, the matter seemed obvious to any regulated mind that contemplated the immensity of the heavens. In the present century, astronomers have been virtually unanimous in their adherence to that cosmology. Some of them even created a branch of science called exobiology, which ponders the probability and nature of life on other planets. The best known of these astronomers is Carl Sagan. Sagan has estimated that 1 billion habitable planets are to be found in our own galaxy. A habitable planet fulfills such basic criteria as being the proper distance from its sun, having enough water and oxygen to sustain life, and possessing an atmosphere thick enough to protect life from dangerous radiation. Of those billion, as many as 1 million, he believes, are home to intelligent life and advanced civilizations. Now these figures are for our galaxy alone. The known universe consists of 200 billion galaxies. That's missionaries. These astropriests will take the gospel to the inhabitants of Mars and other planets. But in a reply to Brewster, Yule pointed out the problem with his idea of a redemption that radiates from the cross to the ends of the universe. It grants the Earth a centrality that pluralism would preclude. Earlier in the century, it had been thought that such proof had at last been obtained by Sir John Herschel, the son of Sir William and himself a noted astronomer. During the summer of 1835, the New York Sun had run a series of reports in which Sir John was said to have observed, by means of a telescope, of vast dimensions and an entirely new principle, various creatures on the moon. Among them were clusters of winged apes evidently engaged in conversation. The reports had created a sensation in New York and elsewhere. But they were soon discovered to be fictional, a satire aimed at the plurality of worlds idea. A trillion stars, around which could be orbiting quadrillions of planets, the same proportion of which, says Sagan, may be expected to have evolved creatures not unlike ourselves. The exobiologists argue, then, from numbers and common sense. They reason that if Earth-like planets exist in such abundance, a significant number of them will have produced life similar to our own. Surely there is life, intelligent life, throughout our galaxy and beyond. As one scientist summed it up, we would be very vain creatures to believe we are the only human beings in the universe. Thus, a belief in multiple worlds became the prevailing view among both scientists and the general public. Yet not everyone would accept that view. And with its ascendancy, a new kind of dissenter appeared on the scene, the Bruno in reverse. These were thinkers bent on returning to the old universe, the universe whose sole inhabitant was man, whose very purpose was man. The foremost of the dissenters was Alfred Russel Wallace, co-discoverer of the theory of evolution. In 1903, the 80-year-old Wallace, influenced by his conversion to spiritualism, published a book called Man's Place in the Universe. In it he repeats many of Yule's arguments, reinforcing them with new scientific data. The universe, declares Wallace, exists for the sole purpose of evolving the human inhabitants of Earth. We are the unique and supreme product of creation, whose ultimate product is our immortal souls. To the objection that it would be wasteful of God to create so many unused stars and planets, Wallace points out that waste is the norm in the natural world. He gives the example of a tree that produces millions of acorns, in order that one of them might become a new tree. The Earth, in Wallace's view, was that single acorn, from which sprang the tree of life. Alfred Russel Wallace had arrived at the theory of evolution independently of Darwin. They published it jointly, but Wallace has been largely forgotten, perhaps on account of his backsliding cosmology, or his unscientific insistence that evolution had been guided by a higher intelligence, a grand designer. Another dissenter was George Gaylord Simpson, a paleontologist and zoologist. Simpson debated the exobiologists on their own terms, by weighing probabilities. In this view of life, Harcourt, Brace and World, 1964, he writes, "There are four successive probabilities to be judged: the probability that suitable planets do exist, the probability that life has arisen on them, the probability that such life has evolved in a predictable way, and the probability that such evolution would lead eventually to humanoids." The first probability is fair, the second far lower but appreciable, the third exceedingly small, and the fourth almost negligible. Each of these probabilities depends on that preceding it, so that they must be multiplied together to obtain the overall probability of the final event, the emergence of humanoids. The product of these probabilities, each a fraction, is probably not significantly greater than zero. More recently, a theory has arisen in scientific circles known as the anthropic principle. Its proponents note that carbon-based life was able to evolve only by dint of a remarkable set of coincidences in the physical structure of the universe. The universe seems to have been designed so as to produce life.